let's turn to the Song of Songs, chapter 3, which we're going to be looking at this morning. You know, I was explaining last week that I've chosen to do the Song of Songs because my central heating has broken, continues to be broken, at home. And so I thought we should generate some heat here in the church by studying this book. You'll know if you know anything about the books of the Old Testament, that the Song of Songs is one of these books that when you read it, you wonder, what on earth is it doing in the Bible? Because it basically is a celebration of physical love between a man and a woman who were in the process of getting married. It's in the context of marriage that it celebrates this physical intimacy. But it basically is a movement from the initial encounter and the stirring up of sexual desire, which we see in the opening chapters, through to the marriage and then the consummation of that desire, and then the consequences and outworking of that. So that's basically where the Song of Songs goes. And it's very much focused on the physical interaction between this man and a woman in marriage. And the other bit that makes it even more difficult is that it doesn't mention God once in the course of telling us this or describing this. And so the question is, what on earth is this doing in the Bible? And through the years, both Jewish and Christian commentators have found it slightly problematic, this book. And they've chosen what we call an allegorical means of interpretation or interpreting it. But basically saying that this is a fictional story with hidden meaning. That's what an allegory is. So it's actually talking about, it's nothing to do with physical love. It's actually talking about the relationship between God and Israel, or between Christ and the church, and everything takes on a particular significance. We saw last week where in chapter 1 when it says, "I'll lay my head between your breasts." The breasts are interpreted as representing the Old Testament and the New Testament. And as he lays his head on the breast, that's to increase our desire to read the Bible. And that's sort of one of the ways that this has been interpreted. Most people nowadays don't advocate that. Well, it's not true. There is an increasing school of thought that feels uncomfortable with that way of interpreting the Song of Songs. And most of them would adopt, some just read it literalistically and see this as a manual that will improve our sex lives in marriage and have read it in that way. Others feel that it provides us with what we'll call an analogy. And an analogy is a fact which is like another fact. So Jesus often said, the kingdom of heaven is like a bird or is like a seed that grows. So he says, you can look at the way you plant a seed and the way it grows and understand something about the nature of God's realm and the spiritual realm. And so there's a relationship between the two. And basically, this is a song or a celebration of physical love, but it is also an analogy in that by understanding the nature of physical love between a man and a woman, we can understand something of the relationship between God and his people. If you think about it, in the Old Testament, often God portrays himself as a lover who married Israel at Mount Sinai, and who then had to suffer the indignities of Israel's idolatries as they committed adultery with these vain idols. In the New Testament, we see the same analogy. Jesus describes himself as the bridegroom who has come for the bride, the church. And in fact, the last verses of the New Testament are actually an invitation where the bride says to the bridegroom, "Come, Lord Jesus, come." And this invitation to come and see the consummation of the relationship between God and his people. And so in that sense, I'm trying to follow that sort of school of thinking. So we're not hiding from the elements of physical love that are expressed in this book, but we're also trying to see beyond these to the wider lessons or analogies between our relationship between Christ and the church. The song itself is set out as a sort of duet, and we saw this last week. where it's a dialogue between a man and a woman. I've encouraged you, if you don't have a Bible that sets out man is speaking, or it's actually the lover and the beloved. If you don't have a Bible that's telling you this is being said by the lover and this is being said by the beloved, go and get one. Because Song of Songs is really hard to understand. It's like trying to read a play without knowing who's saying what, or has somebody else started speaking or not. You actually need it divided up. Now, I know different Bibles divide it up slightly differently, so it's not an exact science. But nevertheless, you have to understand it as this dialogue. I was using the illustration of Grease Summer Nights. Some of you will remember that. And the movie John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John, and they're singing to their pals, and one sings, and then another sings, and sometimes they're pals throw in something. Well, that's basically what the Song of Songs is doing. It's like Summer Nights. It's two people singing and occasional comments getting thrown in. The plot itself and the way the narrative developed, I've suggested a way of interpreting. This is not the only way of interpreting, but I think it best expresses what is found there. Is suggesting that the story is really a Cinderella-type story. It opens in chapter 1 with this girl. She's called a Sulamite. And we see her being oppressed by her brothers, probably her stepbrothers. And she's being forced to work in the fields and look after their vineyards. And because she's doing that, her skin is getting darker. And in the Near East, if your skin is dark, you're not seen as desirable as someone whose skin is fairer. Again, it's just a cultural thing, but this is an element. Even to this day, in fact, when a girl's about to get married, they usually try and keep her out of the sun for about 12 months in order to help her complexion get paler. And this was causing her a real problem, because the fact that her skin was getting darker meant that she had no prospect, or she felt she had no prospect, of ever finding a husband, of ever finding a partner, ever having a lover. And so here our wicked brothers are forcing her to work in the fields. Her skin is going to get darker, and she's going to be beholden to these brothers for the rest of her life. And then suddenly, one day, we have the entrance of the shepherd boy. And suddenly he comes in, and we see the descriptions again in chapter 1. She's sort of enamored by his energy and his looks, and he's enamored with her. We don't know if they met at the well, but that's usually where men and women met, at wells. You didn't go to discotheques in the ancient world. But they start this relationship, and sexual tension begins to build between them. And we see the sexual tension building in chapters 1 and chapters 2. In fact, the sexual tension is such that we're actually given a warning, which is that do not waken love until it is ready. It's reiterated in chapter 2, verse 7, and in chapter 3, verse 5. What it's saying is, once you light this element of sexual desire, it's very, very hard to stop it. There's actually a scene where, at the end of chapter 1, where they're pretending that they're in a bed together. And they're saying, the grass is the bedspread, and the boughs of the trees are like the structure of the bed. And so you just imagine two teenagers sitting out in the grass, envisaging that they're in bed together, and the kind of sexual energy that's probably happening there. And then they have to go away. Well, that's what happens at the end of chapter 1. So you see this kind of building up. Anyway, what happens is the young shepherd boy, he says, I've got to go away, but I'm going to come back and marry you, I promise. And the girl accepts this, and he disappears. And suddenly she's desperately bereft, because she's lost this young man who represented her future, had brought all of this hope, and he's gone. And we read in chapter 3 a dream that she has, and we'll look at that more closely in a minute. And then in verse 6, we read this scene of the arrival of the king into the village in which this girl lives. And you'll see in chapter 6 the description of Solomon coming with all his entourage and all the men in front of him, all probably the trumpets, the music, all the ceremony of the arrival of a great king coming to his northern estate. And the girl goes down to see the arrival of the king. There's great excitement. And she looks up, and as she looks up, riding in the chariot is the shepherd boy that she has fallen in love with. And she realizes that it was the king who was her lover. And we then read in chapter 4 how the king takes her and he makes her his wife. And then we read of the consummation, the physical consummation of that relationship. And then we read a little bit about what kind of happens subsequent to that. And so that's roughly the plot. What's very, very interesting is the way that the Song of Songs actually looks at those elements surrounding this consummation and the excitement of the physical attraction that exists between this man and a woman. Usually pop songs only give you one side of the story. They just give you all the positives. All the positives, whether it's sex is amazing or relationships are brilliant and falling in love is the best ever. And there's an element of that in the Song of Songs. Certainly there's a lot of celebration of physical love. There's a lot of celebration of love and the attraction between a man and a woman. And yet there is some very interesting stuff going on in between some of these songs and some of these solos. Most interestingly of all, there is actually two dreams. We see one dream in chapter 3, and this consists of the woman after her shepherd boy has gone off to the city. He said to her, I've got to go and do something in the city. And she has this dream that she wakes up and he's gone. And she goes to find him and she searches everywhere, desperate to find him, desperately seeking him. And she goes to the city and she seeks him everywhere that she can. She speaks to the police force of the day and she says, have you seen him? A missing persons kind of alert. And she searches and searches and suddenly she finds him. And the dream involves taking him back home to her mother's house. Suddenly she has recovered her love. We then get a similar dream in chapter 5 after she is married and consummated her relationship with Solomon. And it's interesting, we get another dream like this, another dream of absence. She's lying in her bed and suddenly her lover arrives at the door and he's trying to get in, but she's paralyzed. Have you ever had a dream where you feel paralyzed? Well, she's paralyzed on the bed and she can't get up. And he's at the door and he's trying to undo the latch and he's banging at the window and she can't get up to let him in. And suddenly she finds that she's able to get up out of bed. She races to the door and he's gone. And so this frantic search again takes place as she rushes, searching for him, looking for him, trying to find him. But this dream actually turns into a bit of a nightmare. Because rather than finding him, she actually ends up beaten up by the watchman, the policeman that had helped her previously. And she finds herself alone and abandoned. Really interesting, the two dreams. And actually, this occurs after the marriage, after the consummation of this physical love. And one would be anticipating happily ever after. And again, I don't know how you interpret these two dreams. I mean, you could interpret, have a sort of feminist critique of this. It's kind of like, it's a typical man, isn't it? He'll come along, promise you the earth beforehand, get what he wants, and then he'll rush off somewhere else. And with Solomon, we know he had already 60 women, and then he added another 606 or 640 after the Solomite, and then 300 other concubines. So certainly this did not work out happily ever after. And there's echoes of this here. And I think these echoes are really, really important to understand. Because although we have a celebration of physical love, and again, we're surrounded in our culture by that same message that sex is everything. Sex is wonderful. Finding a man that you love or finding a woman that you love is just blissful. And everything comes alive, and everybody lives happily ever after when that happens. It actually questions that sort of narrative. See, there is a very, very acute difference between fantasy and reality. And as Christians, we need to be acutely aware of this, especially in our culture today. You know, there are all kinds of notions out there. I was saying in my previous church There was a lady who her husband died, and she was probably getting into her 80s. And she decided, I don't think we quite had internet dating, but she decided to write to, I think you had a personals page where you could find people. And she joined one of these agencies and started to go on dates with men, and quite a few men as well. Now, there was nothing untoward in terms of that, except that she was choosing to sleep with every man that she went out with. And not only was she choosing to sleep with every man that she went out with, she was then choosing to come to the group that was the equivalent of our excess here in the church and tell them all about her exploits with this guy. Now, this raised some very interesting questions for us as a church. And I was like, oh, okay. And in fact, there was a weekend where she eventually settled on a guy. He was 13 years her junior. A bit of a toy boy, actually. And they came in the church weekend together. And she went to the person who was organizing the weekend. And she said to him, Alistair says it's okay if we share a room together. And then she came to me and said, the guy that's organizing the weekend says it's okay if we share a room together. And I went, really? And anyway, we talked to each other, and we discovered that we were getting the wrong story. So what we did was we put her at one end and our new boyfriend at the other end with the guy that was organizing it in between the middle. The sort of thing that you would do for 16-year-olds. And it was just surreal. And there was all kinds of questions that were going on in terms of this. Obviously, there were the issues of the morality of the thing. What is appropriate morality or not? There was the issue of, should we be talking about, I mean, is it really great or appropriate for someone to be talking about sex like this anyway, particularly at that age? Sometimes we feel like that at the church, don't we? Even these kind of sermons, should we be talking about sex even? Isn't this a private thing? And again, even the Song of Solomon is quite discreet in the way it talks about sex. And there's a sort of sense of this is maybe a private thing. Reason we need to talk about it is because if we aren't talking about it, other people are. And that means they're setting the agenda and we're not setting the agenda. But it also raised this interesting question about this notion, and it's a sort of universal notion, that everybody is entitled to a sex life, no matter what age, no matter what situation in life. Everybody is entitled to enjoy sex before, during, and after marriage, and that your fulfillment is somehow all tied up in enjoying these sexual relationships. And this has sort of permeated our society. It's a sort of notion that now we accept as second nature. But actually, often it obscures the tension between fantasy and reality. And again, I find it very interesting that in a book like the Song of Songs that celebrates physical love, it has this darker underbelly of that whole scenario. Over Christmas, I noticed that, you know, Barbie dolls. Do you remember them? Yeah. I see Mark remembering them. Maybe he played with them when he was younger. But you have Barbie dolls, and you have these images of what women are meant to look like. And they had really long legs and really skinny hips and really large busts and beautiful flowing hair. Okay. Now, just do a quick survey. How many of you have ever met a woman that looks like that? Okay, all right. Eddie thinks his wife does, so that's good. And what was I saying about fantasy and reality? Anyway, and the people who make the Barbie doll, is it Intel, have decided that they're actually going to make a more realistic Barbie doll that actually conforms to real proportions, and they're going to change the shape. Now, why are they doing that? The reason they're doing that is because they understand that this image that they're generating, this fantasy, this notion, is actually shaping people's reality. In fact, I believe you can get her a boyfriend who's called Ken, who, again, looks really hunky, and you can work out the perfect relationship that they have. And the problem is that notion, that idea, begins to shape what people do and how people behave. There's certain research that would actually suggest images like the Barbie doll are directly correlated to the increase of anorexia amongst teenage girls. Why? Because there's an image being put out there, an image that is an impossible ideal. It isn't real. It's a fantasy. It's a notion. But this image is taken as a reality to which people aspire to, and a reality to which people begin to conform their lives to achieving. And actually what happens is these fantasies often prove to be hollow. See, Song of Songs kind of shows this. Here's this girl, and she's building her whole life around this man. This wonderful guy who's going to take her away from her life. He's going to take her to this wonderful place where she's going to be loved. She's going to be affirmed, where she can enjoy the physicality of their relationship. And everything is going to be wonderful. And she's going to live happily ever after. And yet here in chapter 5, we read the correlation of the two dreams. And the first dream, she finds her lover and takes her back home and they live happily ever after. But the second dream, she goes to the city and ends up beaten up and alone. Which one do you think is more realistic and more the reality? And yet the fantasy is perpetrated. The fantasy is there. And this is a powerful force that determines our behaviors. You know, the number of people that I know that end up in adulterous relationships because they've been driven by some kind of notion or fantasy. The person that I'm with, well, maybe they're not that interesting. Maybe they're not that exciting. Maybe we don't have the sexual energy. But I've met someone, and wow, they're my soulmate. Wow, we have this amazing sex life together. Wow, everything is great. And if I could just go and be with that person, then everything will work out wonderful, and we will live happily ever after. Do you know the statistical return on people who leave their marriages for someone they're having an affair with? That only 1 in 20 last 5 years. And actually, many of those that I know that have gone the distance and lasted more than 5 years very quickly discovered that this person that was supposedly their soulmate isn't anything like their soulmate. And many people that I know who have made those kind of choices end up really miserable in their subsequent relationships. And yet this fantasy, this ideal has been promoted and given to us. And it begins to shape what we're doing. What is the notion? Well, the notion is that we will find true human fulfillment. We will find our true identity. We will find the realization of our deepest longings through sex and through a relationship with someone else. And that actually, without that, so if you don't have sex and you're not in a relationship with someone, then you cannot possibly be fulfilled. I want to tell you this morning that that notion is a lie. You see, the craving for love that we see in that first dream, and there is a deep craving. She's desperate to find it. And she's rushing because she thinks that the craving for love and the thing that she's searching for and the thing that she desires will actually be realized by finding the beloved. And she finds him, and then she brings him back to the house, and she thinks, I found it. I've got what I'm looking for. I'm fulfilled now. I'm complete. Everything is realized in my life in the way that it should be. And yet 2 chapters later, she's finding that is a very, very empty experience. You know what happens in our day and age is people think, well, you just have to go and find another relationship. And so you go off and you seek it again in another relationship and then another relationship and another relationship. Whether you're single or whether you're married, there's this propensity to these relationship cycles. And actually what happens, we get more beat up relationship after relationship after relationship. Very soon we're very incapable of actually expressing the kind of love that is being talked about here in the Songs of Song. Why? Because we've bought into this unreality. We've bought into this fantasy. Now, here's the thing. The craving that people have, that search for love that is often expressed in a desire for sex and the craving and searching for sex, and actually expressed in terms of physical appetites, will only be realized in relation to God himself. See, there is a relationship between physical love and the spiritual relationship that a person has with God. But that longing, that craving, that searching for love will only ultimately be realized in a relationship with God. You see, God is the foundation for that. And although this woman here in the story is trying to put it onto an individual, onto a human being, the reality is no human being can ever fulfill that. See, in my marriage classes, I often sit people down, and I do reality therapy. I don't do marriage classes that much, but I did meet a girl who had done marriage classes with at a party recently, just before Christmas. And she was telling me how every time she has a fight with her husband, she quotes stuff that I say. Strangely enough, my wife found that really ironic and funny. But they were talking about what I call my reality therapy. You see, I have this wee theory that one of the big problems that we have with marriage, and even marriage enrichment and all of these ideas, is that we load ourselves with unrealistic expectations. And you get this from the very earliest days, growing up watching Disney cartoons. How do they all end? You know, the prince and the princess get together and they live happily ever after and everything's perfect and they look perfect. And it's all wonderful and they're all fulfilled because they've got it together. We're getting taught that from the earliest ages. We're learning that, and that's the expectation that we come. And I'll sit people down, and I know I'm maybe anti-romantic in this regard, but I sit them down and I say, you know, there will be periods possibly in your relationship where you would prefer to be out of this relationship than still in it. There may be periods in this relationship where you find yourself more attracted to someone else than your spouse. There will be periods in this relationship where you will feel incredibly unfulfilled and frustrated. And because usually they're doing chapters 1 and 2 of Songs of Solomon, sitting on the couch. And actually, that's the reality. And I want them to know that reality. Why? Because when that reality dawns, they'll understand something. That actually making a marriage work is not ultimately about this fantasy. Is not ultimately about the sense of total fulfillment and completeness in some other human being. It's actually in the tough choices that you make on a day-to-day. I always express it like this. There is a gulf between what you want and think you need and what there is. There's always a gap. There's always a gap in life. And the way you navigate that gap determines how successful you will be in your life and in your marriage. But it's all rooted, and a lot of these fantasies are rooted in this notion that you will find your fulfillment and completeness as a human being in relationship to another person, and particularly sexually in relation to another person. And I want to tell you that is a lie. You know, I was having a conversation with someone who was in a same-sex relationship, and they were saying, are you denying me fulfillment as a human being? In terms of what you're saying by questioning my lifestyle. And I said, I'm not denying you fulfillment in terms of your life, but I'm saying you'll never find fulfillment ultimately in some human relationship. You will never ultimately find the fulfillment that you're looking for purely sexually. You will only find that fulfillment in a relationship with the Creator God for which you were created. And one of the big problems of our culture is that we're trying to transfer a relationship that should be about God, and we're translating it into a relationship that's about other people. And maybe our spouses, or maybe our lovers. And we're translating that into the search for sex. And so what we've done is we've divorced a spiritual reality from a physical reality. And what that means is everything ends up sexualized. And in fact, what begins to happen is that love and sex are set in opposition to each other. See, here's the second truth that you have to realize. Sex is not an end in itself. God did not create sex as an end in itself. Again, we're told, oh, no, that's really archaic type of thinking. Again, it used to be self-evident before the advent of modern contraception that if the purpose of sex was actually to generate babies. And with the advent of modern contraception, we've managed to move away from that concept. But sex has become much more an end in itself. But you see, when we treat sex as an end in itself, What often happens is that we begin to seek the pleasure rather than affirm the other. C.S. Lewis puts it brilliantly. He says, when we say a man wants a woman is the last thing that he wants. He wants a woman in the same way that a man says, I want a cigarette. See, the man doesn't really want a cigarette. He just wants a cigarette because the pleasure that that cigarette will give him is derived from that cigarette. But as soon as the cigarette is smoked, he is no longer interested in the cigarette. He throws it away. And he says it's the same with a woman. When a man says he wants a woman, he's just interested in that woman, not as an end in herself, but as a means to an end, where sex has become the end. And very quickly, and again, our society has embraced this idea. So the affirmation of pleasure rather than personhood has become paramount in sex. And sex is all about performance. As singles, people go out and they think, well, sex is the first thing that you do. You know, because it's not an expression of intimacy or commitment. I remember chatting to some girls that worked at a coffee shop that I used to drink in. And I was trying to figure out kind of the way that they were expressing things. So the first thing that you did was you slept with someone. Okay, so that's the first thing that you do. Yeah, you sleep with them. And then if you sleep with them a few more times, you might be seeing them. And I'm going, seeing them? Yeah, is that going out? No, it's not going out. It's seeing them. What's the difference between seeing them and going out? Well, seeing them's not exclusive, so you might choose to sleep with some other people as well. Oh, okay. So that's seeing them. And then if seeing them develops further, sort of maybe 4, 5, 6 months, we might start going out. And then we're going out, which might become more exclusive. And I was sitting, and I felt old. Okay? And I was just, what is our societal teaching? What are we learning? Because that's actually the exact opposite of what the Bible says sex is about. Sex is designed to be the expression of intimacy between two people. And hear this out, and particularly in terms of marriage, this is really important because I think people have these expectations that in marriage we should have, and again, it's sometimes generated by Christians, sometimes by the interpretations of Songs of Song, that somehow Christians should have the ultimate fulfilled sex lives, and if they don't, there's something wrong with their sex life. I want you to know that sex is about the expression of intimacy. It's about the love that exists to people being expressed. And whether that looks like something from a James Bond movie or something from Bart Simpson actually doesn't really matter that much. What matters is that it is an expression of intimacy. And you see, the problem is we have a whole generation that, fueled by a fantasy, are learning that sex is basically about performance, not personhood. Sex is about deriving a pleasure from another individual and using another individual to derive that pleasure rather than actually an affirmation of love between two people. Who actually, how good the sex is or not, is not that important in terms of the expression of the togetherness of the individuals involved. And actually, you know what's happened? Is that instead of enjoying sex more, because we've moved it away from intimacy, we actually enjoy sex less. Sex is now filled with all sorts of psychological issues. Psychological issues for girls, for guys. Can we perform? Can't we perform? We have people who are in marriages that have lasted for a long time sitting and thinking, a sex life isn't what it used to be or isn't what I want it to be. Maybe I need to go outside of this relationship to go and find it. Why? Because it's now a fundamental human entitlement that I will find my fulfillment in my sex life. But actually, it's a lie. Sex is to be an expression of intimacy. And if it becomes anything other than that, then what we find ourselves is using people. And you know what's happening in our society? Is that we are developing a way of actually using one another. We're objectifying one another and we're turning people into means to an end rather than ends in themselves. And you know what this generates? It generates loneliness. Because we become incapable of building intimate relationships that God intends us to build. Why? Because we're trying to turn physicality, we're trying to turn human relationships into the be-all and end-all that we find our fulfillment in. We're trying to turn them into an end rather than a means to an end. And we're learning to use one another. And we are in a desperate predicament as a society and as individuals. And we need to recover something. And again, I think we're seeing it in the Song of Songs. We need to recover the notion that it is only in God that you will ultimately find your fulfillment. And that means if you are single, your answer to your fulfillment and cravings for love is not ultimately found by getting another relationship or getting into a relationship. It's actually found in relationship to God. It means that we don't see sex as an end in itself, but as an expression of intimacy. And we endeavor as Christians to cultivate intimacy before, during, and sometimes after marriage. We base the expression of personhood on the affirmation of the other, just as Christ expresses his love towards us in the affirmation of the other, rather than in trying to transcend and turn people into means to an end. I believe that's the reality that stands and combats the fantasy, the delusion. And my prayer is as Christians that we actually recognize and begin to affirm something that's different from the world around us. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I thank you for your word. And I thank you for the challenge of the Song of Songs. I thank you for the celebration of physical love. And I thank you that it affirms the importance of physical love between a man and a woman. And yet, Lord, I thank you that it doesn't see this as an end in itself. It doesn't see this as the be-all and end-all of everything. I thank you that it affirms that our cravings for love cannot ultimately be fulfilled by another person or through sexual intimacy. Lord, I thank you that we can only find that fulfillment. We can only be realized as human beings in relationship with you. Lord, I pray that you would help us to discover and cultivate that fulfillment in relationship with you, and through that, to develop our relationships with others. I ask this in your name. Amen.